blackness is not an affirmative force. It simply reoccupies the space vacated by the light.
This is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio.
It should be uncomfortable for a believer to live as a hypocrite.
Delivering people out of the bondage of mainstream media
and the philosophies of this world.
God has called you and me to be his ambassadors, even in this dark moment. Let's not miss our moment.
And now, the Hamilton Corner.
Good evening. Welcome to the Hamilton Corner here in American Family Radio. And I'm your host, Abraham Hamilton III. Thank you so much for joining the program, preparing for your weekend. As you are doing that, most of you are making your way from your part-time jobs to your full-time jobs, thinking about how you are going to outfit this weekend, thinking about and preparing your hearts and preparing yourselves to gather with the saints of God to worship. Man, I encourage you never to allow that to become just a common thing to you, that you stop and consider, wait a minute, God has redeemed me by the precious blood of the Lamb. And think about your own testimony, the great depths that the Lord has stepped down to, how he sent people your way, where he called you from. And then consider that everybody who's a believer who gathers with you to worship this weekend, that the Lord has done the same thing in their lives. Man, what a glorious honor and privilege it is to first of all be able to worship the true and living God, and second of all, to gather with the saints. Man, it's a down payment on what we get to enjoy in eternity. And so, man, I endeavor to consider it that way so that it never becomes common to me, that I never regard the people of God as castaways, you know, just as people that you can brush by. But you think about, man, God redeemed them by the precious blood of the Lamb, just like he redeemed me. It's an awesome thought and consideration to have. And so as you're making that transition from part-time job and part-time work to full-time work, I want to encourage you to do so with full intentionality, in full cognizance that you stop. If you're driving in your car and you think about, man, I'm on my way home. I am stepping into a harvest field for the glory of the King. I know I endeavor to do that myself. I think about that myself. It's an amazing thing to be a Christ follower, and it's a privilege, a distinct honor and privilege to serve the Lord. Praise God. Well, we're going to begin today in Colossians chapter 2. And this is going to be a little bit different for some people. But I want to drill down a bit to offer something to provoke us in thinking in these terms and to really be able to put our full weight down on this thing that we have, this Christianity, this followers being a follower of the way of Jesus Christ. All right. Colossians chapter 2. It's a portion of scripture I've shared before. But I'm going to read one verse, and then I'm going to drill down a bit on this one verse. Colossians chapter 2, verse 8 is the one I am going to read. Now, I've talked about this before. This is Apostle Paul writing to the Colossian believers at about 62 AD, and this is what he says. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental or basic principles of the world, not according to Christ. I'm going to read it again. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ. When we consider where we are, when we consider the clash of worldviews that is reverberating all throughout society, you really can boil it down to two considerations, or one consideration. The clash is, who would prevail, God's word or man's word? You pick your issue, no matter what it is, what will prevail, God's word or man's word? Now, the obvious response, especially if you're listening to me and you may not be a Christ follower, not an obvious response, but a frequent question that is propping up in our day. A lot of younger people are asking these questions too, are asking this question too. And the question is this: how do we know the Bible is true? How do we know the Bible is true? And I have a thing, I do a teaching in this area on it, but I just want to delve into some philosophical considerations, because when you pose the question, how do we know the Bible is true? There are some intrinsic presumptions that are being made even in that question. I give you two of them. How do we know? In order to ask that question, how do we know the Bible is true? There's a presumption that knowledge exists. How do we know the Bible is true? And there's a presumption that knowledge exists. There's a second presumption, really two more. There are three total presumptions in the question. But the second presumption I'm going to highlight, how do we know that the Bible is what? True. The second presumption is that truth exists. And so when you consider the totality of the question, how do we know the Bible is true? The three presumptions intrinsic to that question is that one, knowledge exists. Two, truth exists. And three, we as human beings have the capacity to understand it. Those are three major, major presumptions in the question itself. And I'm going to make a huge and bold statement here that in order to even ask that question, the person presenting the question has to borrow from a biblical worldview. Now, why can I say that? Because if you're going to ask a question that presumes knowledge is true, that presumes knowledge exists and that truth exists and that we as human beings have the capacity to understand both knowledge and truth, my response to you would be, on what basis do you even ask that question? On what basis do you have to offer the considerations that knowledge exists, that truth exists, and that we as human beings can understand it? In order to present that question, you have to borrow from a biblical worldview. Why is that? Because unless God's word is true, or let me say it this way, the only basis to account for the idea that knowledge exists, that truth exists, and that we can comprehend it, it draws from a biblical worldview. For example, the basis for knowledge. We don't have to go far. We can go right up to Colossians, the same chapter where we are, verses 2 and 3. Look at this. That their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love, to reach all the riches of full assurance of understanding and knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ. Okay, Christ is that knowledge of God's mystery. Then look at verse 3. In whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. In a biblical worldview, Christ is the fulcrum of knowledge. But if you do not ascribe to a biblical worldview, what is your foundation? What is the basis for your presumption that knowledge exists? Secondarily, truth. You remember when Jesus stood before Pilate and he asked Pilate the question, and Pilate posed the question to Jesus, what is truth? While Pilate was beholding truth personified right before him, Jesus said himself that I am the way, the truth, and the life. Within the biblical worldview, we have clear foundation for both knowledge and truth. Jesus Christ is truth. But if you don't ascribe to a biblical worldview, what is your foundation? What is the basis for your presumption that truth exists? And thirdly, that we as human beings have the capacity to comprehend truth. I mean, if we are just a product of single-celled organisms growing to become more complex organisms, just a product of amalgamation of primordial sludge, then what is the basis for your presumption that we as human beings can comprehend both knowledge and truth? But with the biblical worldview, we have a clear foundation for that. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 27. Human beings are made in the image and likeness of a logical, intelligent God. So because we are made in the image of this logical, intelligent God, we as human beings have the capacity to understand knowledge and truth. You see, unless God's word is true, which accounts for knowledge and truth existing, and that we as human beings are made in the image of an all-knowing, logical God of truth, then no one and no worldview can even proceed to answer any question. You could prove nothing unless God's word is true. Because when you think about truth and knowledge, you know, one of the primary tenets of an atheistic worldview, a macroevolutionary worldview, is that your entire worldview is framed off of materialism. You know, but when you consider knowledge and truth, You're talking about abstract concepts. You can't taste knowledge and truth. You can't touch knowledge and truth. Can't smell it. Can't hear it. Can't see it. You can't measure it. Knowledge and truth have no mass. They're abstract. So then how will you be able to form your base presumption that knowledge exists and truth exists? You have to borrow from a biblical worldview to make that assertion. You see, brothers and sisters, the Bible is true. And this really is built from Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God. The Bible is true because any alternative would make knowledge, logic, and truth impossible. Now, I want you to think about this. In this segment, I'm not asking you to merely hear what I'm saying and take it at face value, but I want you to think through it and handle this and navigate these considerations. The Bible is true because any alternative would make knowledge, truth, and logic impossible. All right? The Bible is the only book that has the preconditions for knowledge, logic, and truth. All other worldviews must borrow from the Bible for the world to make any sense. Science, you know, that phenomenon that reduces or that requires stimuli to be measurable, observable, and repeatable. Well, science is only possible in a universe where stimuli can be repeated and measured and observed. It requires order in order for the discipline to exist. Morality. Science, morality, and logic all stem from the Bible being true. If the Bible were not true, then knowledge would be impossible. In other words, if the Bible were not true, nothing would make sense, whether good or bad. Everything would be meaningless, pointless, and unprovable. And let's think about a couple things. We've already talked about knowledge, logic, and truth. I've mentioned science. In order for the discipline of science to exist, the universe must have order because you can't have repetition in an orderless universe. But I'm going to go further. The idea of holidays. You know the root word of holidays? Holy days. Now, if you are advancing an atheistic macroevolutionary worldview, why would any day be holy? You have no answer for that. But if you understand the Bible, you have clear foundation for holidays. Let's go to another consideration. One race. If you adhere to macroevolutionary theory, the touchstone of which, as advanced by Charles Darwin, is that the more civilized race would ultimately exterminate the uncivilized races. Where's the lie? Where's the lie? Other than the biblical worldview, what is the basis that we have as a society to reject ethnocentric partiality, to reject racism, to reject things like slavery? I'll tell you. The biblical worldview makes that make complete sense, which is probably why it was Christians armed with the biblical worldview that led the global abolition, the global movement for the abolition of slavery. William Wilberforce in England, the abolitionists in America, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Lyman Beecher. I've been enthralled by just studying how the Second Great Awakening led to the return to Christians in America re-embracing the idea of the Imago Dei and saying this is unconscionable that we would treat people made in the image of God as if they're chattel property. If you don't have a biblical worldview, what is the basis for you adhering to that understanding? But with the Bible, it makes perfect sense. We're all made from one blood, one race. There's no such thing as multiple races of human beings. It's one race. We come from the archi-parental couple, Adam and Eve, and then post the global flood, we have Noah and his sons. A couple other considerations. Medicine. Why do we want to seek to heal bodies? If you had it, the hero of a macroevolutionary worldview is death. Death is what allows you to move from one less complex form to a more complex form. But because of the Bible, men and women made in the image of God, we seek to help people. Absolute morality, right and wrong. Here's a huge one that probably goes overlooked. If you don't adhere to a biblical worldview, why do you wear clothes? I drove by a couple squirrels on my way into work this morning, and I passed by the squirrels. I knew they didn't wake up and say, hey, let's get dressed for work. They don't wear clothes. Why do you wear clothes? Without the Bible, you don't have an answer for that. With the Bible, we have a clear answer. Genesis 3, with the fall of man. What I'm saying, folks, very simply, is that the Bible is the only source that makes everything around us make sense. Without it, we can't understand knowledge, truth, or our comprehension as human beings.
Shining light into the darkness, this is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio
and Urban Family Talk.
Welcome back to the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio. This is Abraham Hamilton III. The first segment, really, you got to look behind the curtain between some of the conversations my wife and I have been having in private. But it's just amazing to see that when you consider the concept of knowledge, truth, and mankind's capacity to understand knowledge and truth, you really have to borrow from a biblical worldview, borrow from the Christian worldview to understand those ideas. And when you think about it, you'll see, man, ultimately that is the case. And it really goes back to the fact that the Lord really hardwired us for eternity. He really has done so. Well, there are a couple big stories I want to get to now. And I guess I should let you guys know this, because right now I'm recording this particular segment, this particular show. And at the time of the recording, there's a scheduled vote in the House of Representatives today. That's important. I want to talk about that right now. So I'm going to have to update you on what I'm about to share with you now, but I want to put it on your radar so you can be aware of it. Remember when the conversations, when we had the conversations on this program about first H.R. 5, the misnamed Equality Act that I call the Tyranny Act, that sought to include within the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in every area where the protected classes, the legal protected classes were established, the proponents of H.R. 5 sought to include sexual orientation and gender identity. As we talked about it, they had 240 some odd co-sponsors. You only need 218 votes in the House of Representatives to pass it. And so that ridiculous monstrosity of grotesque piece of legislation passed out of the House with no problems. I had about 8 Republicans that voted for it, I believe. And I warned you then that there was no way to stop the juggernaut from the House of Representatives. But the only hope, the next immediate hope, was in the Senate, and then ultimately to recall on President Trump to veto the legislation. And I do not expect Mitch McConnell, who is in an election year, to bring the H.R. 5 up for a vote in the Senate. But I warned you then there were two other ways that this thing would be foisted upon the American people. One is that there is a fairness for all legislation, which is a compromise piece of legislation, which is really not compromise at all, where it would exempt churches and religious organizations from the application of sexual orientation and gender identity being elevated to protective class status. But I say it's not much of a compromise, because if you happen not to be clergy, or if you happen to just be, not just be, but happen to be a business owner who is a Christian, and then your free exercise of religion rights are completely stripped from you with this fairness for all. And then the second source of compromise that I warned were coming, And I think I said this was the one that was most immediate, and then fairness for all behind it, was a compromise on the part of legislators to amend the Defense Appropriations Bill to include sexual orientation and gender identity verbiage in that legislation. I expressed concern there because you would have Inequality Act verbiage attached to a funding bill for our military that could compel some Republicans to get wobbly-kneed, to say, okay, well, because I need to vote to fund the military, that I'll have to compromise on this by including this legislation. Well, I am unhappy to report to you that just last night, the House Rules Committee amended the National Defense Authorization Act, which is appropriations, which is an appropriations bill for the military, amended the National Defense the National Defense Authorizations Act, and NDAA, amended it to include Equality Act styled verbiage. Didn't we say it was coming? Yep, the Rules Committee added this language to the NDAA. And so today, at about 1 o'clock, between noon and 1 p.m. Eastern time, it is expected, and I'm saying expected, because, you know, you have a Democrat majority in the House now. Nancy Pelosi is the House Speaker. We don't get as much information on the specificity of scheduled votes. But we're expected to see a vote today between noon and 1 p.m. on the NDAA as promulgated in the House of Representatives. And of course, you know, they included this LGBT affirming language in the NDAA. They fast-tracked this piece of legislation. Are you surprised? I'm not. They fast-tracked the legislation. And so the House is expected to vote on this tonight, today. Now, at the time that you guys are going to hear this, the vote will more than likely have already occurred. But I want you to be aware that this is happening. Because, again, just like with H.R. 5, with the Democrat majority, there's not much hope of Republicans stopping this legislation in the House of Representatives. The hope is stopping it in the Senate, which is why I'm presenting this to you now. I know we are working. The American Family Association is working on some things, putting some things together to get you involved, to contact your senators to stop this thing dead in its tracks on the Senate side, to get the U.S. Senate to say, listen, if you are going to include H.R. 5 style language, LGBT, attempting to codify the protected class status of sexual orientation and gender identity in a defense appropriations bill, that is a poison pill. And we're not playing that. We're not tolerating that. We will, should this ridiculous legislation make it out of the Senate, call on President Trump to veto it. Because one of the expressed objectives of this amendment advanced by, what's this guy's name? Spire, Congressman Spire, was to reverse the president's ban on transgender people serving in the military. That's one of the goals. Now, we don't like that. We want to reverse that. So they passed, they're presenting a bill on the House floor today that includes LGBT affirming language that will also reverse the president's ban on transgender serving in the military. Yeah. Folks, don't shoot the messenger. I'm just telling you like it is. This is in the legislation. This is in the legislation. And unfortunately, it's expected to pass in the House of Representatives. And so those who profess to adhere to a biblical worldview, those who profess to understand the constitutionalist orientation that is necessary for this American Republic in the United States Senate, you're going to have to reject this bill and have the confidence, the courage, and the ability to articulate that this is not about opposing funding for the military. This is about prohibiting the military from being used as a social experimentation tool. This is a rejection of the efforts to glob onto funding our military with this elevation of sexual orientation and gender identity to protected class status. And you know, I got to tell you, I don't like coming here, having a report on this stuff, convey this stuff to you. But I think it's important that you know what's going on. It's important that you know what's going on. So that's happening in the House of Representatives today. Another big story from this morning is Alexander Acosta, the Secretary of Labor in the Trump administration, announced his resignation today. Now, why is he resigning? Well, one of the major things that has occurred with the Southern District of New York arresting Jeffrey Epstein and charging him on sex trafficking charges. One of the bases for allowing that to happen is that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York found that the prior conviction that was sustained against Jeffrey Epstein on this, where there was a 53-page indictment where he was facing decades of prison time, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and let me tell you that the 53-page indictment was a federal indictment, indictment on federal charges. Well, those charges in 2007 that ultimately resulted in the 2008 conviction of Jeffrey Epstein, which allowed him to serve only 13 months in jail and to register as a sex offender, which that is important. But that plea bargain was entered in state court in Florida. It came with a non-prosecution of the federal charges from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Florida. And at the time that this all occurred, Alexander Acosta was the U.S. attorney in Florida. And I said when this first came out that that is unconscionable. One of the assignments I had as an assistant district attorney is that I prosecuted sex crimes. I never prosecuted a sex trafficking case of this volume. And for Epstein, whatever his name is, snake, nasty snake, to get the sweetheart deal, it required the feds, which came under U.S. Attorney Alexander Acosta's jurisdiction. It was his office that agreed not to go forward with the federal charges to allow him to plead in the state court. Now, Acosta has said that, you know, there are factual considerations and, you know, he wasn't the only one involved in it or whatever, whatever. But listen, folks, one of the fundamental tenets of leadership is that when you're the head of the office, the buck stops with you. The buck stops with you. And so the New York U.S. Attorney's Office has been able to reopen this case because it found that when the non-prosecution agreement was entered, was entered by Acosta's office, and the state district attorney's office was allowed to prosecute Jeffrey Epstein, that the victims, the young girls who were the victims of the sex trafficking, were not notified. This is a violation of federal law. Now, in addition to that, Epstein's guilty plea, 13-month prison sentence, and registration as a sex offender prohibited him from having what it was discovered upon his arrest in New York most recently. This dude had thousands of pictures, of pornographic pictures of young girls, many of them with names on them. Well, this is a violation of his status as a sex offender. That's illegal. He can't have that. And so I said before, the current charges against Epstein's is two charge indictment in New York have a total of potential 45 years in prison. That's a virtual life sentence for the 66-year-old Jeffrey Epstein. But now you have Alexander Acosta, who has announced his resignation from the Trump administration as the Secretary of Labor. Now, President Trump came out and said Acosta did a great job as the Secretary of Labor. He probably did. I don't have any questions about that. But here's a question I do have. Why would the Trump administration appoint Alexander Acosta if he has this horrible non-prosecution agreement deal with Epstein from 2008? So you have two things, and I know the talking snake media is going to try to connect Trump to Epstein. You know, listen, the facts, wherever the facts go, that's where they go. There's no sacred cows. President Trump said he denies any engagements, whatever, with Epstein. And it is factual that Donald Trump, about 15 years ago, kicked Epstein out of his Mar-a-Lago resort, kicked him out. It was reported to him that Epstein was harassing a young girl in his Mar-a-Lago resort. Trump kicked him out, banned him. That's factual. All right. But the question I have is, then what made you appoint this guy, Acosta, to the Secretary of Labor position? And both of these answers are not good, in my opinion, for the Trump administration, because on the one hand, if you knew about this non-prosecution agreement and you still appointed him, why did you do that? And if you didn't know, why didn't you know? I mean, this is not like this is a small case. There are some, you know, and I attempt to follow the facts, but I will tell you there are some reports that the non-prosecution occurred in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Florida because of Epstein's connection with high-profile of individuals. Like, for example, here's a fact that the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office that is prosecuting Epstein, it's being prosecuted in the Public Corruption Unit. Isn't that interesting? Not traditionally in the sex crimes unit. Normally, when you have cases like this, sex crimes and trafficking of young girls for sex, the sex crimes unit would be the one that would prosecute these cases. But this case that Epstein is being prosecuted for in New York is being handled by the public corruption unit. It's pretty interesting if you ask me. And it's happening because the allegations are that Epstein was connected to some pretty high profile people, and that this agreement that resulted in him serving 13 months in Florida and registering as a sex offender on a solicitation, on one count of solicitation of prosecution, occurred because of Epstein's connection to some pretty high individuals. There are also some reports out today that suggests that Acosta was required to stand down on his prosecution because that were federal governmental agencies were using Epstein as an asset. We know that Epstein's connections go all the way into the royal family in Britain. Was the American government using Epstein as an asset to blackmail high-powered people in the country? Folks, this is ugly, is what I'm telling you. And I think it's smart for President Trump to accept Acosta's resignation because you do need to get him out of there, but that doesn't end the questions for me. You know, did you know about this before you appointed him? And if you didn't know, why not? This is crazy, folks. This is crazy to me. But this is where we are. And I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again now. This Epstein case, oh, it's going to be some very powerful people who are looking over their shoulders right now. I've already talked about Bill Clinton, his 26 trips on the Lolita Express, five of them that we know from manifest records from Epstein's plane that he ditched his Secret Service detail to go fly on this plane with this sick man, this nasty man. Alan Dershowitz has been accused of cavorting with Jeffrey Epstein and his paramours. This is going to be interesting. This is going to be interesting. I have a story here from David Montanaro on Fox News that says Jeffrey Epstein's indictment in New York is a placeholder for some other big names that they wanted to get him indicted and get him off the streets immediately. Because there's some other people that want to rope in. And I've already shared with you that One American News has reported that Epstein has already agreed to sing like a canary in exchange for a five-year sentence on these charges. Now, I can tell you as a former prosecutor, folks, you don't have people that offer to serve 5 years in prison right off the bat after indictment unless they already know that they're guilty.
The Hamilton Quarter podcast and one-minute commentaries are available at AFR.net. Back to the Hamilton Quarter on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the Hamilton Quarter on American Family Radio. Got some more foolishness du jour to get into. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Many of you know her name, but many of you may not be familiar with the name of her chief of staff. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I'm just going to call her Cortez for now because that takes a lot to say all of that. Self-described socialist, a democratic socialist. Like you can fool us with the Democrat in front. But anyway, you're familiar with her name, but you may not be familiar with her chief of staff. His name is Saikat Chakrabarty. Saikat Chakrabarty. Well, in an interview he gave to the Washington Post, this is something, man. Chakrabarty confirmed what many constitutionalists have already articulated at length, that this Green New Deal, they're calling it the Green New Deal, you know, because climate alarmism is a little bit more docile in most Americans' minds as compared to, I don't know, socialism. You say socialism and that piques Americans' interest. Well, Chakrabarty was being interviewed and made an admission that I felt was pretty interesting. According to the Washington Post, Chakrabarty had an unexpected disclosure. He said, quote, "The interesting thing about the Green New Deal is it wasn't originally a climate thing at all." Now, the context of this conversation, folks, is that Chakrabarty was talking to a man by the name of, oh, I see his last name. I want to get the first name. Ricketts. Yes, Sam Ricketts. Now, Sam Ricketts is the climate director for Washington Governor Jay Inslee. If you don't know, Jay Inslee is running for president. He's one of the 17,455 people running for president in the Democratic Party. Now, Jay Inslee, he doesn't have a shot. Let's be honest. Jay Inslee, he's not going to win. Jay, if you're watching or listening, which he's probably not, you're not going to win. All right. Jay Inslee's main issue is climate change. That's the whole thing that's the thing he's focusing on. So Chakrabarty is talking to Sam Ricketts, Inslee's climate guy. And he says, quote, the interesting thing about the Green New Deal is it wasn't originally a climate thing at all. The Washington Post reports that Ricketts greeted this startling notion with an attentive poker face. Then Chakrabarty went on, quote, do you guys think of it as a climate thing? Because we really think of it as a how do you change the entire economy thing, end quote. Now, I'm going to translate for you because I speak Chakrabarty if you don't know. When Chakrabarty says, because we really think of it as a how do you change the entire economy thing, he's admitting that the Green New Deal is just the Trojan horse to advance socialism in the United States of America. Ta-da! Now, if you listen to my program, you've heard me tell you this. Because if you were focused on on climate change, then why would you try to include things like, I don't know, a federal jobs guarantee? You know, if your focus is climate change, why does your legislation include within it, I don't know, the free college for every citizen of the United States of America? Things like that, you know, that kind of let the cat out of the bag that your focus is not climate change. Your focus is socialism. And now we have Chakrabarty admitting it. Because when you accompany cow farts with massive new entitlement spending, this entitlement spending is not necessarily directly connected to the cow farting. And now we have Ocasio-Cortez's chief of staff admitting what we all know. And now there's some Democrats right now in Congress who they don't like Chakrabarty. They're like, he has to go. We have to get rid of this guy. They don't like him. But, you know, the thing for me is, why y'all don't like him now? Like he's changed up or something? Because what a lot of people may not know about this psychot Chakrabarty is that he has a penchant for this former Indian head of state, former prime minister in India, by the name of Subhas Chandra Bose. Now, most Americans don't know who that is. Subhas Chandra Bose. He was the prime minister in India from 1943 to 1945. Anybody know some big thing that happened around that time? I don't know. World War II. World War II. And did you know that Subhas Chandra Bose was an ally of Adolf Hitler? Yeah. Met Adolf Hitler in 1942. Shook hands with Adolf Hitler. Not only that, Subhas Chandra Bose founded the Free India Legion, made up of troops captured by Nazi Field Marshal Rommel. Marshal Rommel. And this Nazi Field Marshal Rommel created what's known as the Africa Corps. Mm-hmm. The Africa Corps. Mm-hmm. And these are the troops that were Subhas Chandra Bose's Free India Legion. Saikat Chakrabarty, in interviews, wears shirts with Subhas Chandra Bose's face on it. Now, you got Democrats that are upset with Saikat Chakrabarty now, but y'all ain't have no problem with the dude who one of his heroes was a Nazi sympathizer? Who not only a Nazi sympathizer, oh no, the Chandra Bose's Free India Legion swore an oath to Adolf Hitler and was under SS command. Oh yeah. Chandra Bose's Free India Legion teamed up with the Japanese in 1943. Oh, yeah. Work together with the imperialist Japanese. Yeah. Lastly, Subhas Chandra Bose was an admirer of the USSR, and he sought to impose Stalinist authoritarian practices in India. That's Cortez's chief of staff. And you can do your own research. Look, you can do a DuckDuckGo search, because y'all know we don't rocks with Google around here. Do a DuckDuckGo search on Saikat Chakrabarty, and you're going to see him in almost all of his interviews. Almost all of them with the T-shirt with Chandra Bose's face on it. It kind of gives you the impression that he's intentionally wearing this shirt, because nobody wears the same shirt in every public appearance they do. And Chakrabarty, he doesn't want to be the one in front of the camera. He likes to be behind the scenes. So when he has the few opportunities to be on camera, why do you think he wears that shirt? He's telling you who he is. Now, I want you guys to think for 1 second. Just imagine. I know this never happens, but imagine that somebody like, President Donald Trump appointed as his chief of staff a Nazi sympathizer. A person whose hero is a Nazi sympathizer, a person who swore allegiance to Adolf Hitler, a person who put his Free India Legion under the authority of Hitler's SS. Imagine that person was President Trump's chief of staff. Is it making sense now? That is Cortez's chief of staff. And to go a little bit further, because if you're wondering, wait a minute, where do people like this come from? Because listen, Saikat Chakrabarty is a very intelligent individual. He's a Harvard grad. He's committed to socialism. His hero is Subhash Chandra Bose. If you've been wondering, because if you like me recognize, seems like Cortez's elevator doesn't go all the way up to the top floor. You know what I mean? The puppet master, the man behind the curtain, is Chakrabarty. Did you know that Chakrabarty worked with Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks? You know, the Young Turks that gets their funding from, you know, Muslim nations to found an organization called the Justice Democrats. And that these Justice Democrats held like auditions for people who would carry their objectives. If you watch, and I know most of you don't, I do it for show prep purposes, but if you watch the Young Turks, Cenk Uygur for the longest has been beating this drum to oppose Nancy Pelosi, has been beating this drum for primarying establishment Democrats because they weren't socialist enough. They weren't regressive enough. And surprise, Cortez gets to Congress, and what is she doing? She's doing the bidding of Chakrabarty and Cenk Uygur. And Cenk Uygur had the foresight to know that after he got these candidates, he and Chakrabarty got these candidates together, he needed to step away because he had a larger profile than many of them and didn't want the American public to see them coming. Well, you want to know who are four candidates that the Justice Democrats fielded for the 2018 midterm election? You ready for this? Ooh, I know you can't wait. I'll name them with numbers next to them. Numero uno, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. See, folks, she is an actress playing a role. She's filling the role that Chakrabarty, Cenk Uygur, and the Justice Democrats have fit her for. Next, Rashida Tlaib, all supported by the Justice Democrats. Next, third, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota. Yeah. And fourth, Ayanna Pressley in Massachusetts. Now, who are the four Democrats that just voted against funding for the humanitarian crisis at the border that is revealing the fissures in the Democrat Party right now? Yeah, the four women I just named. They are executing the plan that was crafted. One of the masterminds behind it, Saikat Chakrabarty. And he's the one who is now admitting for all the world to hear. Do you guys think of the Green New Deal as a climate thing? Because in the beginning, it wasn't even really a climate thing. It was a how do you change the entire American economy thing. Y'all can play with you if you want. But these people that advance in socialism, they know exactly what they're doing. They're attempting to hook, line, and rope you in by putting Democratic in front of it. But they are advocating for straight up socialism. Period. Just want to let you know. I'm going to move on to something else. This is a better story. Better ultimately, but has some bad components to it. Because following the triumph of the United States women's national soccer team, which, you know, when America wins, I love it. But I have to tell you, some of the main leaders of the soccer team are an embarrassment to me. But one of the names that you did not get to hear, who is probably one of, if not the best soccer player in the United States of America, is a young woman by the name of Jalene Hinkle. If you follow me on social media, on Twitter, I'm at Hamilton Corner. On the Book of Faces, I'm at I have the Hamilton Corner Facebook page. For now, it's countdown. That stuff is going to be going soon enough. I'm just going to tell you. But if you follow me on social media, you saw me post an article discussing Jalene Hinkle. Some of you are asking now, who is Jalene Hinkle? Jalene Hinkle is a 26-year-old soccer player who stars for the North Carolina Courage professional women's soccer team. She has been called the top left defender in the United States game, period. The top left defender in the United States game, period. She is easily top five in all of women's soccer in the United States of America. Easily. But she wasn't on the United States women's soccer team, the national soccer team. And some of you may be wondering why. I'm going to give you a little bit of behind-the-scenes information. So in 2017, Jalene Hinkle refused a call-up from the U.S. women's national team for a pair of international friendlies. Is the soccer term used to describe exhibition games. So in 2017, Jalene Hinkle was called to play for the U.S. women's national team in a couple of international exhibition games. After receiving the call, she learned that the games, because they were close to around the month of June in 2017, that the U.S. women's team would be wearing rainbow-colored jerseys to celebrate LGBTQIAP plus Pride Month. Now, here's the catch. Jalene Hinkle is a committed Christian. And she says, quote, "I just felt so convicted in my spirit that it wasn't my job to wear this jersey." That's in an interview she gave to the 700 Club in May of 2018. She goes on, quote, "I gave myself 3 days to just seek God and pray and determine what God was asking me to do in this situation." She ultimately decided that she would not join the women's national team in 2017 for the sole reason that she refused to wear a pride-themed jersey. Going forward, Jalene Hinkle was not included on this 2019 U.S. women's national team roster. The coach of the U.S. women's team, Jill Ellis, said that it was only a soccer decision. But Jill Ellis is herself a lesbian and is purported to be in a marriage to a woman. And as we have all witnessed now, the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team is a very activist soccer team. Jalene Hinkle's resume includes playing soccer at Valor Christian High School in Highlands Ranch, getting a full scholarship to Texas Tech to play soccer. She's earned 8 caps for international soccer game competition. And in 2018, her team won the Women's Soccer League Championship. The Irish newspaper has reported that Christianity has prohibited one of the best players in U.S. soccer from being on the soccer team. But Jalene Hinkle said, "This is one of those things where you have to put your dream against the peace you get from obeying God." She says the peace that she's gotten from obeying God trumps not being on the women's national soccer team.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.